You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up in today's programme... explosions in Kobane, from the Turkish response to Islamic State militants to the British anti-EU sentiment. We discuss the day's biggest news stories with Daniela Peled and Nina Schick. Then we get the architectural insights of the 2013 winners of the prestigious Stirling Prize ahead of the announcement of this year's winner.
I'd see it more as a transformation. We're taking something that's existing, we're taking very good care of it, but we turn it into something that it wasn't before. So I think that is qualitatively different to restoration.
All that ahead, plus a preview of London's Frieze Art Fair and a check-in with our man in Moscow. That's all coming up right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in a very busy 60 minutes. Before we start, let's get the latest news from all around the world.
Monocle 24 News with Jonathan Wheatley. Germany's Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier has today joined the Saudi Foreign Minister in calling for comprehensive action against Islamic State. Steinmeier confirmed that Germany will not send ground troops to Syria, but said that military action was necessary. The news comes as earlier the US Secretary of State John Kerry said the US was extremely concerned about what he called the tragedy in the Syrian town of Kobane, where Islamic State fighters have been tightening their grip. US National Security Advisor Susan Rice has said that Turkey has agreed to allow moderate Syrian rebels to be trained on its soil in its bid to combat Islamic State in Syria and Iraq.
The president has been very plain that this is not a campaign that requires or even would benefit from American ground troops in combat again. The Iraqi prime minister, the government of Iraq, have said very plainly they don't want American troops in combat.
Russia is ready to expand its cooperation with the World Health Organization in the fight against the deadly Ebola virus, Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Monday. During a meeting with the World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan and his resident Novogari-Ova, not far from Moscow, Putin said world leaders should act wisely to prevent the spread of the disease. Meanwhile, in business news, little-known medical equipment and biotech companies have jumped on Wall Street on Monday following news that a nurse had become the first person to contract the deadly Ebola virus in the United States. Investors have piled into various companies that are either developing treatments for the disease or provide protective gear. In Jerusalem, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon demanded today that Israel halt its plans to expand settlements in East Jerusalem and that both sides quickly return to peace talks for a two-state solution that collapsed earlier this year. Ban visited Israel and the Palestinian territories a day after a conference in Cairo where Western and Arab nations pledged $5.4 billion for reconstruction in Gaza. Ban says things have changed since his last visit.
I traveled to the region than to contribute to the international effort to stop the fighting. This time, I'm here with a message of hope, the hope of rebuilding Gaza and creating a brighter future for the people.
An Afghan official said a NATO airstrike killed seven civilians in the country's east, including a nine-year-old child, but the International Coalition said on Monday that the strike killed eight militants who had fired on its forces. Civilian casualties from airstrikes remain a raw issue in the Afghan war, although UN statistics show the number killed has sharply dropped in recent years. And finally, the British government is planning to sell its 40% stake in the fast-speed Eurostar train operator that links Britain with continental Europe. The sale could raise between £200 and £300 million as part of the government's plan to sell £20 billion of corporate and financial assets between 2014 and 2020. Well, Paul Dayton, the Commercial Secretary of the Treasury, says British or foreign investors would be equally welcome.
There's no strategic or national interest in owning these remaining shares. You know, it's a minority stake. The company operates independently, sets its own prices, its own strategy. It's got an excellent management team. So really, this is just a financial asset. So if we can exchange those shares for good value, it makes perfect sense for the economy to pay down the deficit and use the financial flexibility that gives us to invest in bits of our infrastructure that do need public expenditure behind them.
And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London, exactly 6 minutes past 1800 hours, 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news of the day here in Studio One are both Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London. Welcome both to the programme this Monday. We'll start not too far away from here, the UK Parliament, which votes a little later today on whether to call on the government to officially recognise the state of Palestine. Just a couple of weeks ago, Sweden's new Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, said that his government is going to recognise a Palestinian state. It will be the first long-term EU member country to do so. Could this be a sign of Israel losing the battle for public opinion? I wonder. Daniela Peled, what do you make of this? Is just a meaningless gesture here at Westminster, or something perhaps a little more than that?
Well, it's a gesture that won't have any direct effect on foreign policy towards Israel or Palestine at all. As to a meaningless gesture, I don't think so. I think this is a very interesting trend that we see in Europe and elsewhere, the unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state. And this is responding to a change in strategy by the Palestinian leadership, at least in Ramallah, over the last 10 years, moving away from armed resistance and armed struggle towards international legitimacy, you know, using things like lawfare rather than warfare, and a recognition in international institutions, and even the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. Now, will any of this make a substantive difference? You could argue the only thing that will change the dynamic is if the president of the United States wakes up one day and says, right, OK, this is what's going to happen. But yeah, I think diplomatically and in terms of Israel's image in the world, I think these things have a very important effect.
Anina, would you go along with that? Do you think it's a Europe-wide shift, and does it reflect that maybe a better sort of effectiveness from the Palestinian authorities at how they're sort of selling their case, if you will?
Yes, and I think that in Europe, increasingly, officials are starting to lose their patience with Israel because it seems that they're not serious about the two-state solution. And before this, you know, most recent war even broke out, the EU diplomats were putting pressure on John Kerry, saying that they would be willing to boycott Israel if they weren't serious about the two-state solutions. And I think, you know, the 50-day war has served to entrench that.
I just wonder about the bigger picture here, Daniela. You know, no sort of real peace process ongoing. It's been, you know, several decades, arguably, since that's been the case. Do you think that the Palestinians are driven to be, you alluded to it before, more effective operators, not on warfare, you said lawfare? Does it matter if they get very good at that? Because you also suggested before that the real thing that will make the difference is what happens on Capitol Hill or in the White House, perhaps more significantly. Are they wasting their time?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that the whole international politics is a little step here, a little step there, and occasionally you get wars and you get hard power, but soft power plays a very important part as well. I think it's also interesting to look at how important Israel feels the battle for its public image is. It invests a huge amount of resources, politically, financially, in what it calls Hasbara, which in Hebrew is explaining, or public diplomacy, or less charitably, propaganda. Huge resources trying to change the opinion, not just of policymakers, but also ordinary people. Because I think Israel wants to be accepted as one of the family of nations, as a Western democracy. It wants to be the startup nation and the only democracy in the Middle East. It doesn't want to be seen as an international pariah. It doesn't want to see the prospect of any action by the International Criminal Court. I mean, that's what it's down to. It's Israel, Jerusalem is terrified that Palestine will sign the Rome Statute and join the ICC. Although the chances of any Israeli leader being indicted or actually being convicted by the ICC is very, very remote. It's a matter of public image, and that has huge power.
Anina, what about the if we take the temperature across Europe then, the EU and across all the European nations, do you think that there's a feeling that Israel is doing a pretty good job public image wise, or do you think this marks something of a shift? Do you think there will be more pressure, perhaps, you know, on the Israelis to sort of, you know, raise their game a little?
Well, I think that the role social media has played in desanitizing the war has certainly put a lot of pressure on Israel so that they aren't able to present their version of events as they have been able to do so in the past. I mean, in the most recent conflict, we saw that quite strongly when broadcasters, including here in the UK, were publicly coming out decrying Israel's actions, saying these were, you know, crimes against humanity because of the high number of civilian deaths. And the interesting thing is that's not only been felt across Europe, but even in America, which is, of course, one of Israel's staunchest allies. Polling shows that younger generations are more ambivalent towards Israel than older generations, precisely because of what they've seen on social media with regards to the latest war.
Daniel, what could that bring to bear in terms of back to the UK again? We've got this vote later today, nothing likely to change significantly, but it is interesting to look at how people are being asked to vote. We know that a number of, you know, key Labour figures are suggesting people vote with their consciences or support this motion. David Cameron, the Prime Minister, abstaining, unsurprisingly. It's interesting. He talks about the effectiveness of social media we've seen over the last few months. Is this something maybe in the next electoral cycle here in the UK we could see a shift, or would you remain rather sceptical about that?
Well, I don't know. Is Palestine really the most divisive issue and the most pressing issue in British or European politics? I don't think so. And fundamentally, if you look at Europe-wide, Europe remains Israel's biggest market. Despite all the calls for boycott, divestment and sanctions, there's no sign of that changing. Companies are lining up to do business within Israel. And you have this diplomatic dance of not recognising settlement goods and putting bans here and social media campaigns. Not one of these things is going to make the substantive difference. But I think they all gather together to, you know, they have a effect when taken all together. Will anything fundamentally change Israeli policy? Yeah, that's you were talking about a couple of decades since there was a real peace process. I'm not sure that we see a real substantive change anytime on the horizon.
Could be a few decades more. One final thought on this, Nina. Sweden's new prime minister, you know, they're making some strides. I think it's a bit of a shame that that sort of gets rather sort of kicked into the long grass. Or do you think it's important that we do recognise, you know, when a country like Sweden decides to try and grasp the nettle a bit and set the agenda, even if it doesn't necessarily get everyone talking?
No, it is quite important. And of course, we've seen a swing to the left in Sweden. So, of course, the new prime minister is trying to establish himself as different from his conservative predecessor, although this is conservative on the Swedish spectrum. And it's important because it's the first EU member state that acceded to the EU before 2004 that has formally decided to do this. And that's triggered the debate here in the UK. And of course, for the UK, it has even more important implications because the UK, although this vote is non-binding, is a permanent member of the UN Security Council.
Let's stay in the region. International donors have now pledged over $5 billion US dollars towards the rebuilding of Gaza after the recent 50-day conflict that we were talking about. The top donor, Qatar, $1 billion of aid. Daniel, Qatar sort of prides itself on having a sort of independent foreign policy. What does Qatar want? What's the long game here?
Qatar wants to be the big cheese. I mean, for some unknown reason, as we've discussed, the Middle East peace process is sort of non-existent. Who leads the peace talks and who's involved in it is fairly immaterial. But it's a point of pride. So Cairo has traditionally been the address in the Arab world where the negotiations, you know, the nexus. Qatar wants to change that. And what also helps, I guess, is that Qatar and Egypt are not exactly the best of friends. And this is a great way. I mean, the poor Palestinian people and the poor people of Gaza, you know, haven't they suffered enough? This is very little to do with them. The Qataris have got an invitation to Cairo where they lay down this enormous pledge. And if you consider the tensions between Qatar and Egypt over the Al Jazeera journalists and so on, that's a pretty impressive blow for them to achieve.
I just wonder, Nina, I mean, Daniela describes it there. There's all these different schisms. It's so complex looking from without at all of the different interrelationships. People often talk in loose terms about, oh, well, you know, the Gulf states do this and, you know, in the Middle East, this is the view. And it's so terribly complex. Do people in Europe really understand all of these nuances, do you think? Or are people inclined to just sort of move on and just look at the big numbers at the end of it?
Well, being a Europe analyst, I think that we're fighting fires on our, you know, within Europe. So these issues tend to get sidelined when, you know, things like whether or not the single currency is going to survive is still in question. And our own economic recession tends to dominate the minds of politicians here in Europe.
Daniel, what happens as we look, I don't know, a few years ahead? Will all of these pledges even be paid? Because we've had this sort of discussion before. Is it ultimately futile effort? You can throw money at a problem, but until we get back around a table, perhaps, I mean, I know people in Tel Aviv would say that. Is this meaningless?
Well, I hate to say it, but the cynical view is what will we see in a few years' time will be the exact same thing again, which is that the Europeans, the national community, will line up to pay for the damage inflicted in Gaza in another round of violence. All, you know, the most positive, I suppose, spin you could put on it is that the aid gets delivered, perhaps via the Palestinian Authority, and Israel cooperates with that. And we see a future where the situation in Gaza improves, but there's no military solution to this, and there's no aid solution. The only thing that can be done to improve, really substantially improve the lives of people in Gaza is greater ease of movement, greater access to markets. Any amount of aid or donors is not going to change that. There are an awful lot of very, very talented people in Gaza who want to build their own economy. But that for that, they also need a political and a diplomatic solution.
Those are the thoughts of Daniela Peled. Nina Schick is still with us here as well on Midori House. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll discuss you could call it anti-EU sentiment, I guess, here in the UK, the increasing pressure Turkey is facing to do something about the situation in Kobane. Stay tuned.
The UN Security Council is the roundtable heart of diplomacy that decides when to act on some of the globe's most pressing issues. But is it fit for purpose? Monocle's Steve Bloomfield paid a visit to its HQ to find out.
We blame it, we ridicule it, we say those two letters with our eyes rolled, yet we don't really understand it. We don't really stop to think why it struggles to reach an agreement. The clue is in the name, the United Nations. Since when were our nations united? And if they ever had been, would a body such as this ever need to exist?
Safe and Sound, a photographic essay now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1818 here in London. Still with me in the studio are Daniela Peled and Nina Schick. Let's continue with Turkey, which has been facing increasing international pressure to act whilst Islamic State fighters close their grip on Kobane, a Kurdish-Syrian town in the border region. It now seems Turkey has agreed to allow Syrian rebels to be trained on its soil by the US in order to combat IS across Syria and Iraq. This was announced by US National Security Advisor Susan Rice, although Turkey has yet to confirm it. Are we finally seeing Turkey do something about this situation and its border regions? Daniela, people have been watching and waiting, feeling that it's like almost a dam to burst. Could this be a decisive moment even?
I am a little sceptical, I have to say. I mean, there's talk of Turkey allowing some 4,000 fighters to be trained on its territory. And then there are also rumours that they're going to allow the US to use their air bases to launch strikes, which frankly would have made things a lot easier for the coalition forces. Whether that will happen, it seems frankly unlikely. I mean, Turkey is, I was talking to a journalist earlier today who covers Turkey a lot and has been on the border a lot, and he described to me as Erdogan is walking a tightrope while juggling half a dozen eggs and, you know, whistling happy birthday. And I'm trying to do all of these things. Very, very, very tricky. They don't want to give any ground to the Kurds. At the same time, they have to fend off some of the pressure from the international community. And again, you know, the Turkey can argue, why should we commit ground troops when no one else have? And they have sucked up an enormous burden when it comes to the refugees as well, coming in from Syria. But yeah, to see this tragedy develop in real time on television and social media, I think that's what's just astounding about it. And Turkey is not doing what seems the right thing to do.
Nina, how would you sort of characterise Erdogan's performance on this? Because you could argue that, as Daniela says, some people say he's spinning a lot of plates. Is he in fairly invidious position, or is he just not doing what he should be doing?
No, I think he's trying to strike a delicate balancing act. And of course, the kind of Western strategy led by the US is that they'll provide the airstrikes and then local allied forces will go in and put the boots on the ground, because the question of Western boots on the ground, you know, is out of the question. And of course, Turkey has its own assurances that it wants to protect. Before it commits to any kind of ground forces, it wants to have a no-fly zone over northern Syria. It wants lots of, you know, it's got its own concerns about the Kurdish fighters, who they see as terrorists as well. They want to have assurances that the West will help oust Bashar al-Assad. And before the West makes these assurances, why should it, from his perspective, commit to, you know, a lengthy ground war, which has no end in sight, to be honest?
And Dalia, do you think that it's possible to claim that Erdogan is looking at this as in a sort of back to front way, you know, looking for those assurances about the Kurds, looking for those assurances about tackling Assad? Is he sort of coming at this problem the wrong way, particularly in the light of, as you described, this humanitarian disaster potentially that's unfolding?
Well, do you know what? I think the whole international community is going about this backwards and the wrong way. And I think now we're, you know, rather perhaps unfashionably, I've long been a supporter of intervention. I think now what we're dealing with is the consequences of failing to act again and again and again. And I think now, unless, you know, this is we're presented with no end in sight, but without action. I mean, what we're seeing happening is genocide. It's war crimes by any definition, and not just a civil war, not just a problem which people need to sort out amongst themselves. I think the international community has to act, and this is, at least in Iraq, you know, this is something I think there is a military solution for. There's not a military solution to bring democracy or freedom, whatever. To defeat a discrete military force, yeah, I think that is within the realms of the possible.
Nina, do you think it's been left too late by particularly the West, who maybe should and could have led the way on this?
Yeah, I think that the longer they leave it, the worse it'll get. I mean, the airstrikes have proven to be ineffectual. The IS fighters are highly trained. They know how to, you know, avoid the airstrikes and regroup and come back. So the only way to really push them back is for people to go in and, you know, start this military campaign on the ground. But I don't think that responsibility should fall on Turkey alone, which is kind of what it seems to be at the moment, the West pressuring Turkey to do so, you know, reminding it of its obligations as a NATO member, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the West needs to provide more. Otherwise, this problem is not going to go away either.
Let's switch our sights back to the UK for a moment or two. The discussion about immigration, the European Union, is a sort of escalating discussion, I think we can say that. One of the latest initiatives suggested by London's mayor, Boris Johnson, always game with a bright idea or two. He's called for potentially a quota-based or point system to control migration from the EU. At the same time, the UK Independence Party leader Nigel Farage has said he wants a referendum on EU membership as early as next July in return for potentially supporting a minority Conservative government, should that be the outcome at the next general election. Nina, do you sometimes despair of some of the rhetoric that comes from maybe some of the right-leaning elements of the British mainstream political establishment?
Yes, because I think there's a lot of people trying to work on achieving reforms in the EU, because there is no doubt that Europe needs to reform. You know, it's declining competitive-wise vis-a-vis the rest of the world. You know, it's still an economic crisis. And the fact that these kind of issues then become central. There are a lot of people in Britain who actually have very good ideas on how Britain could actually lead the way in helping to reform Europe with allies like Germany and France on board. But when it becomes something like this on immigration, where you're challenging one of the central and fundamental rights of the EU, free movement, then you're not going to win any allies in Europe. And that's very much a shame.
Daniela, do you sometimes feel a sense of sort of strange collective shame when you hear this sort of posturing from the likes of, you know, Farage, who, you know, until a few years ago was a kind of entertainingly comical, marginal figure and now seems to be a kingmaker in waiting?
Well,
is it slightly kind of shameful when we have to, you know, confront our European neighbours with buffoons like this?
Well, you know, a few years ago one could have said the same thing about Boris Johnson. A buffoon and an amusing character. But actually, those two people are two of the very, very few politicians in British politics right now who have any kind of charisma whatsoever.
Why? How have we come to this?
Farage always photographed with a pint pot in hand, or at least that seems right. But no, seriously, he should calm down a little bit. He's got one MP and he's talking about a referendum as a demand for supporting a coalition.
But I wonder, is that a measure of how concerned the mainstream parties are about the potential damage at the ballot box that UKIP could do?
No, I don't think so. I think if you look at what Boris Johnson said, I think he was very, very clever in his speech, because he knows the British, and I'm prejudiced as a proud Brit myself, are generally perhaps, you know, an island nation, perhaps a little xenophobic, you know, but too polite to do very much about it. And so what he said was, well, of course, you know, the British people have no problem with the Portuguese nurses and the Polish chefs and the Latvian builders, without which our economy would fall to pieces. What the problem they have is the scroungers who come here to sort of exploit our good nature. Now, Nina will have a much better idea than me on the figures of how realistic this threat really is. But I think he calibrated his message quite finely, because I think British politicians make a huge mistake if they go for dog whistle politics, or a really right wing, anti-Europe. To make real traction with the British electorate, they have to be rather more subtle than that.
How do our European neighbours look at us, Nina? Do they consider Brits to be polite xenophobes, as Daniela suggested there?
I mean, the rise of these kind of anti-establishment or anti-EU parties is not something that's unique to Britain. I mean, we're seeing it across Europe. In Greece, you have a party that wants to put mines on its borders to keep foreigners out. I mean, even in Germany, you know, where the European project and European integration is regarded to be so important, you have a party, Alternative for Deutschland, just founded last year, polling in some regional elections at 13-12%, and they want to break up the euro. You know, they're anti-euro. So I think this is larger disaffection across Europe, amongst the citizens of Europe, basically saying no to ever closer union and not agree, you know, feeling that their democratic voice is not being heard and that the distant figure of Brussels is too far away from them to relate to. And one way to deal with that was to make sure that nationally elected parliaments have more of a say in the Brussels institutions and in the Brussels decision-making process. But going back to the immigration debate here in the UK, there's two ways to conceive of it. One would be to regard it in terms of volume, so putting an outright cap on migration of EU migrants to the UK, or in terms of fairness. And that is something where there could actually be a compromise with our EU partners. Basically, they want to rewrite the rules around access to benefits, saying that the national government should have final say here. And by doing so, take out some of the toxicity out of the immigration debate. So then people can't say, you know, so-and-so from Romania or Poland is coming here just to claim our benefits. And that will be the deciding question, I think, in the run-up to the election. Will the Conservative Party stick to the fairness argument, or will they go to the volume argument? And if they go for an outright cap, then I think there'll be a lot of resistance amongst our EU partners.
Just brief on that point, you mentioned this sort of toxic debate, and it so often seems to be that way. Are you disappointed generally? We understand where the sort of populist, right-leaning rhetoric comes from and the job that it can do electorally. Are you disappointed at the sort of quality of the debate, how often the figures are way off target, how often people gloss over the real substance of the issues? Are you disappointed that Britain maybe hasn't evolved in its European rhetoric beyond that by now?
Well, like I said, I think this is something that we're seeing across Europe, and it would be foolish to ignore it, because this debate is coming because this is what the population is concerned about. I've just done the rounds at, you know, the party conferences here in the UK, and the number one concern of almost every MP was, you know, that their constituents were telling them about immigration, fears about immigration. So I think that the mainstream parties do have to address it, but they have to address it in a way that they can make reforms where European partners are also wanting to make reforms. And I think that if you basically give voters the choice of all or nothing, you know, they're going to aim for nothing in the end. So there has to be a middle ground, there has to be a compromise.
Daniela, one final very brief thought then. Am I living in some sort of ridiculous alternative reality where I think we might get some proper good substance to this discussion, maybe ahead of the elections next year here in the UK? Or is that pie in the sky?
Well, in some quarters, you're going to get proper substantive discussion. But, well, I think you're being perhaps, how can I put this charitably? I think you're being a little bit optimistic if you think the tone of the debate is not going to be tabloid in the extreme.
Daniela Peller, the editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, and Nini Schick of the Open Europe think tank here in London. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll speak to our man in Moscow. We'll look ahead to what's happening in the world of art right here in London, and plenty more besides. Before we get started on all of that, though, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Germany's foreign minister has today joined the Saudi foreign minister in calling for comprehensive action against Islamic State. Frank-Walter Steinmeier confirmed that Germany will not send ground troops to Syria, but said that military action was necessary. Russia is ready to expand its cooperation with the World Health Organization in the fight against the deadly Ebola virus, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Monday. In Jerusalem, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon demanded today that Israel halt its plans to expand settlements in East Jerusalem and that both sides quickly return to peace talks for a two-state solution that collapsed early this year. And an Afghan official said a NATO airstrike killed 7 civilians in the country's east, including a 9-year-old child, but the International Coalition said today that the strike killed 8 militants who had fired on its forces. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. More news from Jonathan Wheatley at the top of the hour. 1900 here in London for your next full bulletin of world news. It's 18:32 right now here in London. It's 21:32 in Moscow, where we head next to hear from our correspondent, Josh Yaffa, who joins me on the line with this week's big talking points from the Russian capital. Great to speak with you, Josh. Thanks for joining us, as always. Let's start with a bit of economics, shall we? Inflation is rising, the ruble falling. What's the general mood there? I imagine it's, what, pessimistic at best?
Well, I think it's certainly a mood of uncertainty. People aren't really sure how much farther the ruble can fall, how much farther prices can rise. I think there, more than the fact that you're seeing the ruble depreciate and you're seeing prices go up, what really has people nervous is it's not really clear if we've reached the ceiling yet. How much more will the Russian consumer potentially suffer at the shop, at the bank, and so on? And I think it's that sense of not really being able to predict, will things get much worse? Will things get better? If so, how soon? I think it's, you know, not knowing the answer to any of those questions that has people the most nervous. But certainly for your average consumer, your average Muscovite, they're very much feeling the effect of Russia's general economic downturn. Certainly the deepening or sharpening effect that Western sanctions have had on what was already a rather gloomy picture for Russia's economy because of historical and structural reasons. But whether it's someone going to the shop, a friend and colleague the other night was talking about salmon at his local shop having gone from about 300 rubles a kilogram, so that's under $10, to 900 rubles a kilogram, which is almost $30. One reason for that being that around 70% of Russia's salmon until a month or so ago was imported from Norway, a country that now falls under this food ban that Russia enacted in response to Western sanctions. So it's not something that's just happening on the level of, say, Rosneft, the huge state oil company that's having problems refinancing some of its loans, also can't have access, losing access to needed Western technology to explore hard-to-reach areas of the Arctic. You know, that's one level of the economic story, and a very important one, given how much oil and gas is central to the Russian budget. But it's also a story that's playing out at people's shops, neighborhoods, as they're doing something like going to buy fish for dinner.
Mm. Well, and also it was funny, we saw, of course, President Putin at the Grand Prix in Sochi just this past weekend, whatever it was, $30 billion worth of Olympic Park and F1 circuit. I guess that's not going to be an easy watch to people who can't find their food in their local store. But as well as watching the motor racing, Vladimir Putin's been a busy man, hasn't he? He's ordered these tens of thousands of troops back from their long-term exercises right near the border with Ukraine. Tell us, Josh, what should we, if anything, read into this?
Well, it's certainly part of a long-term game that Putin's been playing over the past several months, as this Ukrainian crisis has ebbed and flowed, and he's used the very public demonstrative exercises in this Rostov region. It's a region of southern Russia right on the border with Ukraine, and the border of particularly these areas of eastern Ukraine that have seen fighting and the effective takeover by these rebel forces. So going back to the spring, really, when he's wanted to put pressure on Ukraine, when he's wanted to send a signal to the West, he's suddenly announced snap exercises and moved tens of thousands of troops to the border, trying to intimidate, frighten both Kiev and Western capitals into thinking he might act and thinking that might be advantageous to get some concessions. But also in other moments when he's wanted to, say, avoid sanctions or signal his interest or willingness in some sort of diplomatic or political solution, he's very demonstrably called off those troops and brought them back to their bases. And I think this announcement from over the weekend that around 17,000 or more Russian troops would now be fully leaving this Rostov area. So it's not just that the exercises themselves are coming to a close, but it's also that the troops are going to go back to their home bases scattered all over Russia. I think many people inside Russia, political commentators, military analysts, and so on, see this as a sign that at least from now, Putin is kind of wrapping up the most intense or militarized portion of his strategy vis-a-vis Ukraine and the West. Either, and here's where opinion varies, either he essentially got what he wanted through the use of military force over the summer and especially August and got a ceasefire on his terms, a kind of de facto frozen conflict in eastern Ukraine, something that essentially fits with his policy goals. So having achieved all that, he can take the troops home, mission accomplished. There's an opposing, exactly 180 degree point of view, which is that the costs of this diplomatic and military adventurism in Ukraine are starting to mount, perhaps linked to the things we talked about in the first section, inflation, ruble, and so on. And he simply couldn't bear the cost anymore, or was afraid of future potential looming costs of his Ukraine policy, and seeing that he wasn't necessarily going to be able to affect the situation in the immediate term, he brought the troops home as a kind of signal, an attempt, maybe even a desperate one, to the West to think about loosening the sanctions regime. Again, two totally different interpretations of what is this inarguable fact, which is these tens of thousands of troops on the Russian border with Ukraine seem to be heading home now or in a matter of days.
We'll keep a very close eye on that situation, of course. The views there of our Joshua Yaffa, Monocle's man in Moscow. Josh, thanks for joining us as always. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll get the architectural insights of the 2013 winners of the prestigious Sterling Prize ahead of the announcement of this year's winner.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle Shop.
This is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, this week sees the announcement of the winner of one of the world's most prestigious prizes for architecture. The Stirling Prize is awarded by the Royal Institute of British Architecture for excellence in the field. This year's shortlist has some of the biggest names in the industry, including Zaha Hadid for the London Aquatic Centre, that was recently converted, of course, to public use after having served as one of the Olympic venues back in 2012. Also shortlisted, Renzo Piano's Shard at London Bridge. Two big projects with big intentions and dramatically different in style to the prize's winner last year. A little earlier today, Monocle's David Pleasant spoke to 2013 winners William Mann and Stephen Witherford of London-based firm Witherford Watson Mann, who won the judges over last year with their radical but remarkably sensitive transformation of a medieval castle, as well as finding out how it's felt to have been in the architectural limelight for 12 months. David also wanted to get their views on this year's contenders.
It was the first time that transformation of an existing building had won the prize.
17 years, so, first time a house had won. I think we were as surprised as anybody else. We wouldn't deny that at all. If you look to William Hill, we were the definite outsider. But what we became quite aware of in sort of, I guess, building up to kind of talk about the project more in these more public forums was that it really was a project which was, in some ways, it was about an idea about the city. And although it seems counterintuitive to look at this sort of rather decrepit sort of ancient monument in a kind of rural landscape in any way connected with the city, it was a project which was all about kind of the value that things that have resisted removal hold, the way that they play in people's imagination, and how there are things in that which really are important in terms of our continuity of experience. And I think, therefore, one of the things that came out of it for us was, to some extent, a greater confidence to talk about those kind of ideas. And of course, if your confidence increases in talking about them, it means when you're competing for other things and presenting ideas like that, you can do that with more confidence too. So it's a kind of, it did have this sort of reciprocal effect.
And have you kind of felt that, you know, meeting new clients, do you feel a certain kind of kudos? Can you kind of judge something like that? Do you feel more people coming to you now in a different way than they might have done before having won the prize?
We've had a few more opportunities. We were getting opportunities. It's not a big step change, I don't think. There are lots of people that would like to add you to their list of people to compete for a project. And there was a bit of that happening anyway. You know,
I think we were on lots of people's radars before. I mean, just factually, from the number of competitions and the quality and interest of competitions we've been doing in the previous kind of 3 years, that hasn't really changed. I suppose what has changed is that we've converted those from second places into a few first places recently, and that kind of confidence probably is decisive.
Yeah, I think particularly at the level of institutions, that kind of external endorsement from that prize is very helpful. You know, it sort of moves you from being seen as maybe the slightly outsiders who had a really strong idea to be maybe the outsiders who had a strong idea which you could possibly back. And that has definitely, I think William's right, that's been the kind of, it's just got us over the line more than we felt we were.
And looking kind of at, you mentioned how you saw it as kind of recognition of the type of architecture, that restoration, that adaptation of historic buildings. Do you think you winning that was kind of enough? Do you think there's more to be done in terms of your field, your specialism? Do you think that there could be more recognition of it? Do you still feel yourself kind of battling against, whether it's the planning system or public awareness of restoration and so on, do you still feel there's a lot more to be done?
Well, I suppose probably the first thing to say is that it isn't really a restoration. I'd see it more as a transformation. We're taking something that's existing, we're taking very good care of it, but we turn it into something that it wasn't before. So I think that is kind of qualitatively different to restoration. I think we seem to have divided our cities into bits where you're not allowed to do very much and bits where anything goes. And I'd like to see that sort of change. I think there's certainly a strong, and going beyond personal taste, I think there's a strong case for change in both those areas, that actually where there is kind of continuity and there's a lot of presence of the past, that still that acts as the foundation for something new. But equally where that isn't there, that you're still kind of trying to achieve some quality scale that is recognisable from, you know, other bits of the city and some kind of durability. I mean, there's bits of town where buildings are 20 years old, are getting knocked down and replaced. That's not the kind of city that we subscribe to.
So definitely more awareness is, I think, required in that sense. This idea of reimagination, I think, is a very powerful idea and way forward, particularly in London. And one of the projects we have won subsequent to getting the award is to look at the Northern Roundabout as a new major public space at the Elephant and Castle, which is a space which has now been cleared. It was cleared at the end of the war, and they built the new Haygate and all of the modernist buildings around that. It's pretty much largely been cleared, or in the process of being completely cleared again, sort of 40, 50 years later. And now there's a sort of scheme to kind of reimagine Abercrombie's Inner Ring, which I think is probably one of the most important projects in London at the moment. Aldgate, Old Street, Vauxhall, Elephant, Euston, King's Cross. This incredible, in a way, change in geography of the centre as it moves out to the Inner Ring and making really important local and public places out of what have always been these incredibly fragmented landscapes.
If we could just finally, I know you're not really in a place to talk about this year's shortlist, but it's again very different to what we saw last year, especially there's probably not a comparable type of project or practice like yourselves on the list this year. Do you have any opinion on what we're seeing on the six that have been chosen?
I think we learnt a lot about what the Stirling Prize is about through going through the process, more than I think we had understood from what gets communicated in the magazines and the press about it. And one of the things that really came across is it was about a building that had made the biggest contribution to architecture in that year. And that was really about an idea. So I think you'd have to kind of go through the list and see what are the kind of really strong ideas that underpin each project. And clearly, some feel like they've got stronger ideas than others. And to that extent, you might wonder why some are on there. I still find it's quite an interesting discussion of why the Shard's on the list. The idea is it's a kind of a vertical extension of the city, but it's kind of totally privatised. I mean, it just makes you wonder what city is it an extension of? It's not an extension of London, and it probably isn't the extension of any city you might ever want to live in. So I think, you know, you'd want to know what is the idea, apart from excellence in craft or just the sheer challenge to make a project like that. I suppose it's one of the things that keeps getting levelled at the Stirling Prize, both in terms of the people who are shortlisted or the geography of that, is just what are those criteria?
That was William Mann and Stephen Witherford of London-based firm Witherford Watson Mann, the winner of last year's Stirling Prize here in the UK and the winner of the 2014 edition, will be announced on Thursday. Let's build, if you'll forgive me the pun, on that last piece with our musical selection next. We're sticking to the architectural theme with In the Future. This is Architecture in Helsinki. Within the future, that's Architecture in Helsinki here on Midori House. Now we're going to play you a preview of Section D, which airs, of course, Tuesday nights at 1900 hours. We'll be heading to the shores of the Danube and to Serbia's capital. Last week, Belgrade enjoyed its annual Design Week, a key event on the calendar in Southeast Europe. There's the usual mix of international and local delegates and lecturers enjoying all the sunny autumnal delights that Serbia's capital has to offer, as well as presenting fresh ideas in architecture, product design, and brand management. But this year, Much of the inter-session chatter has focused on the host city itself. Belgrade is facing its most radical redesign in decades, with the controversial riverfront development that would change the look of a huge chunk of the city centre. The Belgrade waterfront project is funded by the UAE, with a developer from Dubai. But is it the right look for this ancient Balkan capital? Our correspondent, Guy Delaunay, has been testing the water with Belgrade Design Week delegates and some other interested parties.
Well, there's a buzz of caffeine, conversation and creativity here in the coffee bar at Belgrade Design Week 2014. And this year's edition is being held in an abandoned glass factory in the centre of the old town. Now, there are many such buildings like this, not just in the city centre, but all around Belgrade. Relics of the former Yugoslavia, more prosperous times for this city. And the question now is, what should the city do to become prosperous in the future? That's one of the things which was addressed at one of the sessions of this conference on democracy and urban development. And it's a big question for Belgrade at the moment because we're facing the biggest redesign the city's seen in many decades, the extremely controversial Belgrade waterfront project. And the question is whether people have really been consulted enough over such a huge shift in what the city centre might look like.
As an idea to come down to the water, it's great. But as an architect, I would do more open spaces and try to pull back the offices and the big buildings, so to do it more public friendly.
Not consulting the experts in the field specifically is wrong. I mean, that's my personal opinion, and I think that's kind of what I've been hearing from a lot of colleagues.
This is one possible way of developing brownfield site. And the second one is typical real estate development, which attracts different kind of investments. So we have it all, and we have to like use all the resources.
This is what the fuss is all about. It's an area of Belgrade city centre called Savamala, and it wouldn't be uncharitable to say that it's a scruffy neighbourhood, all run-down shops, crumbling facades and heavy goods vehicles churning up the road surface. But the location is spectacular, right on the banks of the River Sava, by the confluence with the Danube, and the potential is huge. Now Serbia's government reckon they've got the key to unlock that, a €3 billion investment from the United Arab Emirates. But there's a lot of opposition, the major complaint being about the lack of transparency or consultation in the process.
They wanted to put Belgrade down to the rivers, and now they will finally get it with the Belgrade on water, which is illusion. I mean, that will be so private and capital-owned that you could not just use the river as they refer at the beginning.
Ivo Čukić is an architect and member of the Ministry of Space, a group which campaigns for the better use of public land and buildings.
What is the problem is the breaking the laws, breaking the constitution, economical issues, urban development issues, architectural issues. So it's very difficult to just explain it in some understandable way. And on the other side, you don't have any media coverage from the other side of the story. You don't have any architects in public talking about that. Have few, but they're in some smaller discussions or some internet portals, which is also not publicly presented.
The Belgrade waterfront project would transform Savamala. The main bus and railway stations would be moved and a skyscraper constructed on the riverbank. The proposed high-end retail and residential developments would completely change the character of the old neighbourhood. In all, it would be the greatest change to the city since the construction of New Belgrade almost 70 years ago. Iva's colleague and fellow architect Dobrica Veselinovic says that's too big a transformation to push through without a proper civic conversation.
If we have some project which is changing the shape and the image of the city, I think we should more involve people to say what they want in that part of city. We see now seeing the spaceship which is landed in some part of city, which nobody knows what it is, to whom it will serve, and what is the purpose of that. if we have example in Berlin that they made a city referendum what to do with the old airport, which is basically just the airport field of Tempelhof, why we don't have some similar initiatives in Belgrade, which is project with I don't know how 100 times more into the and money and the wideness of it.
Of course, there were plenty of experts at Design Week ready to pitch in with their opinions. Among them, a former Belgrade resident, now running his own business in Stuttgart, Miloš Dimčić of Architecture Programming.
Belgrade has beautiful rivers, two beautiful rivers, and I think even Corbusier said when he was here in Belgrade that it's one of the ugliest cities he saw on one of the most beautiful places that he saw. So they have to use that, and that's the river. So it's a great idea, but they have to approach it responsibly. The best thing is to take some time and survey people, and not only people, but the expert community, the architectural community that has to vote on it and discuss it before they do anything.
Monocle's man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay there, and you can hear that report and a host of other great features on Section D, our design programme, premiering, as always, at 1900 hours London time on Tuesday. But that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to my special guests, Daniela Peled and Nina Schick. Today's show was produced by Marco Sippi, researched by David Pleasant and Max Koshek, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Robert Bound has culture for you next after the news. At 2200, don't forget, Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds will be here for the Monocle Daily. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. Same time, different location. A special broadcast from Frieze. And on Wednesday, we'll be at Frieze Masters. Robert Bound will be in the chair. Those are shows you must not miss. So make an appointment to listen to Midori House tomorrow and Wednesday here on Monocle 24. For this edition of the show, though, that's all. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.